On today's episode of The Good Word, Dan Titus joins me to discuss the Knicks and the Pistons in Detroit's first meaningful playoff home game in 17 years. The Clippers dominating the Nuggets. Do they look ready for real prime time against the Thunder? Giannis's future, Jimmy Butler's present, and Minnesota and the Lakers, the scene shifts to Minneapolis. All that and much more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Before we get into the show, a couple of bits of business to get into. If you haven't already, please check out The Good Word with Goodwill on YouTube and make sure you leave us a rating or review wherever you are consuming this audio podcast. It is playoff time, and it came out like sign. That's how excited I am, along with being tired as hell because we are recording on a Friday in the aftermath of Knicks Pistons, in the aftermath of Clippers Nuggets, in the aftermath of whoever the Oklahoma City Thunder are about to sweep. My man Dan Titus back again. What's going on, brother?
What's good, Vin? Man, that crowd must have been crazy in Detroit last night, man. Unfortunate ending to it, but I don't know, man. I still feel like the Pistons have a puncher's chance here.
Oh, no, I definitely have a puncher's chance. I saw some stuff on Twitter just before we began. I saw some stuff on Twitter that said, oh, that arena doesn't sound so loud. I'm trying to figure out what element of the broadcast y'all were listening to, and then I found this out this morning that because of the very unsavory chants toward Jalen Brunson, the volume on the output was turned down as far as transmitting because you didn't want to hear that being transmitted to America. So it probably made it seem like the crowd was more muted than it was. But the New York Knicks, 118-116, they retook home court advantage. I think I kind of expected. I knew the Knicks would win one game in Detroit. I just wasn't sure it was going to be game three, the first home playoff game of consequence in Detroit in 17 years. Like, they got swept in 16, they got swept in 19, but nobody really thought anything of it. This was the first time since 2008 that a crowd was walking into the building expecting to win and hoping to do more than just make a cursory sort of work of the series. What stuck out to you last night, Dan? Because a lot of things in the building stuck out to me. We're going to talk about was it a backcourt violation? Was it not? Was the clock malfunction? We're going to talk about that. But before we get there, because I don't want to spend so much time on that, what stuck out to you in game three of Knicks Pistons?
Karl Anthony Towns was finally aggressive. 31 points. He had 11 points in the first quarter. So from the jump, he knew what he needed to do. And I think that's where the Knicks, I think, long-term are going to have the biggest problems is, like, when are you going to get that consistent cat? Can you get that consistent cat every night? And, you know, they had four starters scoring 20 points. That's the kind of distribution you want out of four or five starters because Tibbs is going to play those guys the most minutes. So I think there is still some concern, though. These Pistons keep on having their inexperience cost them the game. It's not the Knicks taking it from them. It's the Pistons fumbling down the stretch. And I can't not but notice Cade Cunningham's turnover issues. I mean, he's averaging over seven turnovers in this series compared to only four in the regular season. And he's also struggling from his two-point field goals. He's shooting 46% on that. He was over 50% in the regular season. So as much as Cade is having to shoulder much of this load, he's going to need Tobias Harris to do something, because what I saw last night was the same thing we've been seeing in Philly for the last three, 4 years, was Tobias gets to the moment and he just completely disappears. You can't have your first field goal come in the fourth quarter. It was a clutch one, but he needs to be better, more assertive, and get involved in the game. I love this matchup, man. This is one of my favorite series in the playoffs right now. And I still feel like the Pistons can get it right if they can get that late game execution down.
It wasn't even late game execution. To me, it was they were playing from behind to start because Karl Anthony Towns got off. And I want to touch on what you said about Cade and his turnovers. That goes hand in hand with Malik Beasley not being able to hit shots, with, you know, having a non-scorer in the starting lineup like Asar Thompson, who you need to defend, Jalen Brunson, and who's not ready to be a full secondary playmaker yet. Like, I think ideally you don't want Kay to be this 43-minute super high usage guy. Now the floor is so much more shrunk. He's got one of the best defenders guarding him in OG Anunoby, who I put on my all defense second team. And OG had a really good night.
Yeah.
You made a great point about Tobias Harris. And that, once again, goes with Karl Towns, right? Because he got in foul trouble. He got off the floor, that 2 fouls in the first quarter, 3 fouls in the first half, disrupts any type of rhythm that he could have had. And he had a great game, too, in New York. So you kind of knew maybe he was going to sort of come back to earth. Jalen Duren does not know how to defend Karl Towns in space.
No.
And that's just always been a problem for him. He's not, you know, the most fleet of foot. He's powerful, but he's not necessarily quick. He's always had a problem guarding stretch bigs. Karl got those threes in semi-transition where he's just sort of lagging behind. Then you see someone swinging to him at the top of the key. And before you can realize that the offense is still getting set, the Knicks have made this adjustment. I'm seeing if I can get producer Dakota to post this photo of OG Anunoby getting a dunk in the first quarter. It was like 3 minutes into the game. It almost felt nondescript. But Josh Hart had the ball on the left side with Jalen Duren guarding him. Brunson was in the screening action. Towns was in the screening action. And because Detroit is hugging Brunson, because Detroit is hugging Towns, that just allowed both of those guys to be screeners and pretty much decoys for OG Anunoby to slide back door and get a dunk. And it looked pretty innocuous. It just looked like a play. Maybe Kate fell asleep. But it was a wrinkle in the offense that I was like, oh, you're going to use Detroit really pressing up on Brunson, really trying to press up on Towns against them in a way. Like, these are the adjustments of the playoffs, Dan, that I really, really like, because you start to see who can coach. And I really like Tibbs as a playoff coach. I think he leans into the guys that he likes, but I don't think that he leans into the strategy that he employs. He's got more wrinkles than you think.
Yeah, that was a counter, it seemed like, to J.B. Bickerstaff putting Jalen Duren on Josh Hart in game two a lot, because he could then use, because he knew that, you know, Josh Hart's not going to be shooting a lot of threes. He's usually the guy that's going to be penetrating, kicking, and getting out in transition. Jalen Duren was able to help a lot more. But now that you're involving Josh Hart in more of those actions, then you're going to have to get other people on the back line to have to commit. And they were getting lost. They just didn't understand the defensive assignments. And I think it was a great point that you made, because there's quite a few possessions where you see Cade and Duren like, yo, that was like, where was the back help? Where was the... Just kind of confused on that back line there, because they was getting those easy buckets on the back line.
No, it's tough. I mean, look, Josh Hart was doing Josh Hart things, right? They use him as the playmaker. You know, there's so much usage with Brunson and Towns, theoretically, that when the Knicks went to ISO Brunson in the fourth quarter of game two with 10 minutes left, I said, oh, the game's over. Because you're not involving anybody else.
No.
The foul merchant stuff was disgusting. There were a couple of plays that I absolutely hated. Like him running into Asar Thompson and then running into Malik Beasley. He got caught an offensive foul. They went to the screen, replay, and saw it. And they were like, no, he bumped into Thompson first, which then caused him to bump into Beasley. So they reversed it, and it wound up being a foul on Thompson. Like, that's the youth that comes in, and maybe some veteran savvy, maybe some trickeration of the referees from Jalen Brunson. I found the FU Brunson chance to be, you ain't have to do it, right? I don't even know if people heard it as much on the TV. Like, if you're not in Detroit, you might not have heard it being in the building.
Yeah.
But I thought if you had chanted, stop flopping. Like, maybe that's a little bit better, right?
Yeah, yeah. I feel like the Dallas crowd and their FU chants are more warranted than like a Brunson in Detroit type of thing.
He's public
like,
enemy number one. That's all. And I think people are not used to Detroit being on the national stage. So maybe you're used to Little Caesars Arena being this very quiet place.
Y'all got some fiery motion you got to get out, man. You haven't been there since 2008. You know what I mean?
There's a joke that I could make about people having pent-up emotion, but I'm going to shut up because we are a family-oriented podcast here, and I'm not trying to get in trouble. I want us all to have good jobs. Now, one of the last point, because game four is the tell for me. Game four is where you find out who the better team is and who's going to win the series. And those two things are not always mutually exclusive. You can find out who's going to win the series while knowing they're not the better team.
Yeah.
There's only so many more adjustments that you can make. I expect Cade Cunningham to get downhill a lot more. If Malik Beasley doesn't hit shots, you're screwed. If Isaiah Stewart doesn't come back to be the boogeyman on Karl Towns, you're screwed. And for the Knicks, they've been doing this once again with, let me go through these minutes for you. Josh Hart, 40 minutes. OG Anunoby, almost 43 minutes. Karl Towns, 41 minutes. Mikal Bridges, 39 minutes. Jalen Brunson, 39 minutes. They've got to get more from their bench. Yeah. Just in terms of, because they look gassed at the end of the game, Dan. And that brings me to, let's talk about the officiating real quick. Right? Let's just get it out the way. What did you make of the non-backcourt violation that Zach Zarba did not call on Jalen Brunson with what, 5.8 seconds
left? It was a backcourt. Like, I mean, they could talk about momentum taking him over behind it or whatever, but like, me just watching the game, it looked like a backcourt. He looked like he caught the ball on the wrong side of it, and then it came over to the backcourt. So like, I don't, even though that was the call, and then they had the malfunction with the shot clock.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the Pistons had their chance, and I wanted to ask you,
what was the
reasoning behind Jalen Duren taking that inbound pass? Why did he jump and throw the ball? I just don't understand why he was the one to make the pass.
Because he's the guy that you can't trust to make a quick decision catching the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it was with 0.5 seconds left,
yeah.
You have enough time for a shot. You can't dribble. You don't have to tip it. I think it's with 0.3 seconds left, you can only tip, but with 0.5, you can actually catch and release cleanly. That to me says with where they inbounded the ball, and you inbounded the ball in front of your bench, so you have to throw it on some level of angle anyway, they were going to put Mitchell Robinson in front of whomever anyway, so you can't put anyone who's short there. Mitch is going to completely obscure it. So that was probably your best chance. Like Jalen Duren, remember the jump ball that Jalen Duren clearly was going to win, and he tapped it a little too hard, and it wound up going out of bounds? Those are just youthful plays. Now, I want to read, because Zach Zarber, I believe, is one of the league's best, if not the best referee lead official in the game today. Like, he's the guy. And in the pool report, Omari Sankofa of the Detroit Free Press asked Zach Zarber about the backcourt violation. And here's what Zach said. Rule 4, Section 6G, whatever that means, because we ain't got the rule book.
These bylaws.
We don't have the rule book. I wish we did, right? I wish we did. It says, the front court backcourt status is not obtained until a player with the ball has established a positive position in either half. In this instance, during the throw in the last 2 minutes of the fourth period and the last 2 minutes of overtime period, if any overtime period. So obviously that is where we were at that point. Brunson and the trajectory of the pass were headed towards the backcourt. Brunson's momentum was taking him there when he touches the ball. Due to that momentum, he's not considered in a positive position at the time. That's why the play is legal.
Okay.
Here's what comes in. People are like, well, why is it only the last 2 minutes? Because after timeouts, you are taking the ball from half court or right past half court after timeout, sideline, out of bounds. So that's the only place that it would actually apply. Usually you're taking it wherever. You're taking it in your own front court. Your own back court, excuse me. If you slow it down, it looks like Brunson is parallel to the sideline when he catches it and then turns his body. Now, that's where you had the benefit of replay and slowing it down slowing it down. So maybe, who knows if it was or wasn't. I tend to believe the Pistons had their chances. You can't be crowing about it when you couldn't shoot worth a damn in this game, and you committed a lot of plays that found you down by 10 at halftime, down by 14 at halftime, down by 12 in the start of the fourth quarter. Like, you were fighting from behind all game. I understand that's a close call that makes you feel a little wonky, but you can't put a situation like that in the officials' hands anyway, or any other team's hands to decide that fate. But the bottom line is, Dan, Isaiah Stewart's got to come back. They need their toughness. They need their boogeyman. The Knicks discovered their toughness in some ways, the team they used to be last year. But I don't think they can live off of that type of emotion from game 3. I think this series is going to settle into a comfortable place Sunday in game 4.
Yeah, they need Beef Stew back. Paul Reed was fine, I think, in his you know, bench minutes that he did get. He did have a couple of good blocks and good hustle plays. He tried to scrap a little bit like Beef Stew, and I don't think it holds the same
Nobody
weight.
Nobody believes Carl Towns is here to fight.
I love everybody be trying them, though. One thing I wanted to note, I feel like the game to me, there was a couple of huge momentum swings. You posted about the one where K did the spin move, went up for the layup, and it missed, or it was defended by Karl-Anthony Towns pretty well, and then Jalen Brunson had the layup on the other side. The other one that comes about was just like their second quarter turnover run. They can't have that in game four. I think they had six turnovers in the second quarter, and they were all struggling from the field. Like, you can't have those lulls. So hopefully they can, you know, raise the floor by getting more high percentage shots, get K downhill. And Malik Beasley actually shows up. I mean, what you got out of Tim Hardaway Jr., you may not get that again. I mean, he was unconscious in the first half. So they're going to need some people to step up. And then on the Knicks side, man, I think it's just more the same, man. Brunson just continues to be the most clutch player in the fourth quarter. Like, give him the ball, doesn't matter. He accounted for like 68% of their team's points in the fourth quarter. Just continues to get to the line, makes buckets, even whether he's foul baiting or not, man. This dude just...
How do you feel about the foul baiting? Let's go there.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
I don't think he did it that much last night, but other games for sure. Like, I just don't like the call that... I think it kind of started with James Harden with the pump fake. You jump into the guy and then you get the foul call. Like, I don't understand why the NBA can't just remove that. Like, it's not the defender's fault that they're lunging into you. And if you're lunging into someone, that's an offensive foul. So I don't know why that's still not, why that hasn't been corrected and why it continues to just be like a tactic or a skill set for certain people to take advantage of.
Yeah, I thought, look, it's not the playoffs unless both teams are crowing about the officiating, complaining about the officiating. It's not the playoffs yet. And both teams leaving last night complained about the officiating. J.B. Bickerstaff talked about the backcourt play. He talked about another play where he felt like the officials ran too much time off the clock before Brunson got fouled on his last play and that left 0.5 on the clock and everything else. Like, there's a lot that goes into that. And I think we have too many reviews anyway, too many stoppages.
It's making the game too long.
Right. So I get why the officials don't want to anyway. For Brunson, I think that style, if we're going to say that the officiating changes from October to April, or really October to February, then February to April, then April to May, then May to June, like, it gets tighter. You got to do a lot more. That puts a cap on what the Knicks can do, how great they can be with Jalen Brunson as your best player. And I know people got in trouble last year for saying, I don't know if a guy at 6'1" can be your best player on a championship team. But there's only been a couple dudes that actually do it. Let's be perfectly honest.
Right.
One dude is a dude who played in my town.
Yep.
And Jalen Brunson ain't no Isaiah Thomas. Another one is Steph Curry. And Jalen Brunson ain't no Steph Curry. Right? No shade to him. It's just saying, if he's your best player, there's going to be a limit on it. And the fact that they're in a hotly contested first round series that we're not sure they're going to get out of, I suspect they will, but I'm not sure they're going to get out of, shows you there's a limit to how far you can go with this being your number one source of late game offense, regardless of what the clutch stats say.
Facts.
Let's get to the game that required no clutch stats, no clutchness. Because the Clippers came home to their first game at the Intuit Dome and put the beats on the Denver Nuggets. Beat them down, right? Lost by 34 points. I thought by looking at that, you would think, oh, man, the Nuggets didn't adjust to things from game one and two. Dan, I felt like the Nuggets said, Kawhi Leonard, you're not going to beat us. James Harden, you're not going to beat us. We are going to sell out on all of you guys and make Zubats and Norm Powell and Nick Batum and Derrick Jones Jr. beat us. And that's exactly
what they did. Facts. So I was going to say my biggest takeaway from this game is I think I said it a couple weeks before the playoffs started. I was like, I think the Clippers are going to surprise some people. You're like, oh, the Kawhi health or whatever. But I was like, nah, it's their depth, man. Like, their depth is crazy. And you've always been very complimentary of Ty Lue and his coaching and what he does in the playoffs.
Best playoff coach around.
What he's doing with Nick Batum. And I think Nick Batum is just one of those guys that you just have to, he's just one of those seasoned vets that you have to have on your team in the playoffs. He yes. does all of the, he can play defense, he can guard multiple positions. His no dip three, no time wasted on that shot. Only like Klay Thompson does that. But then also his playmaking. He had like 5 assists. He just is that glue guy that can give you the minutes that you need and the role that you need at the right time. And when you have someone like Kawhi Leonard and James Harden being your rock and your core, anything else you're getting is playing with house money. Norm Powell was playing like crap the first 2 games. And then look, comes back and drops 20 points. Ivica Zubac, 19 and 9 rebounds. This team is deep. Bogdan Bogdanovic hasn't even gotten busy yet. I think this team is really going to make some noise. And I don't think, I mean, as much as you can look at the Nuggets, I think that their injuries are going to probably be their detriment more than anything. But I think the Clippers could actually go pretty far here, man.
Are you? No, wait. Let me slow this down. Let me rewind this. Bad boys behind us. Let's see what you're saying. Are you saying that the Los Angeles Clippers of Inglewood, who would be set to play the Oklahoma City Thunder in the very next round, the first seeded Oklahoma City Thunder, the damn near 70-win Oklahoma City Thunder, are you saying that the Clippers can beat the Thunder or will beat the Thunder in the conference semifinals? I just want to put it on the record.
I'm not going to say will. Can? Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the deep enough team that I think can scrap down to the level of Oklahoma City and actually push people around. Because that's the thing. Like, we could talk about the Memphis game, but that just got out of hand. But I think there's a point where experience is going to matter. And I think that this is that matchup against Oklahoma City is the one where I think we're going to see Shea tested more than he's been yet because of what you said, that coaching of Ty Lue, I think is going to be able to figure out. Him and Jeff Van Gundy are going to be able to figure out something to complicate things more than they have so far.
So a couple notes before I dig deep into what you just said there. Nikola Jokic had another triple-double, and it was meaningless.
Yeah.
And I think it's at a point where they're so heavily dependent on him offensively to create plays. Like, he had 13 of their 20 assists. And I know that guys weren't hitting shots. The bench didn't do anything. Like, I get that. But because you're so heavily dependent on Jokic, especially with MPJ and his injury, he may have to sit game 4, which would be another big-time loss for them. Because you have to depend so much on Jokic, they are tearing him up on the screen and roll. They are tearing him up defensively, and he's not getting help to where, man, I got to play up on the level of the screen, and now I'm chasing the play, and now we're in rotation, and now someone has to help me, and I got to get back to the rim. Like, this is a laborious thing for Nikola Jokic in this series. Like, he's playing against a team and a player in Ivica Zubac that is a physical matchup for him. And because they run so much Harden Zubac pick and roll, that's tough. And because you're trying to help out on Kawhi Leonard and you don't want to leave Kawhi Leonard on the island, and usually the Nuggets double big as opposed to double and small, you got to help on everybody. And I just don't think that you have an energy reservoir that is limitless. Everybody has a limit this time of year. And I feel like maybe we are seeing that with Nikola Jokic.
I think Zoo is such an important piece of this team because their offensive rebound, he's averaging like 5 offensive rebounds in this series per game. That's a huge, getting those getting those second chance points is what separates, I think, the good teams from the great teams. And you don't turn over the ball a lot. You get offensive rebounds. You have James Harden and Kawhi Leonard healthy. Like, this team, I think, can actually do more than people are giving them credit for. And we'll see. But I think it is, to your point, I think it's more about, you know, Jokic versus everybody. Because Russell Westbrook tweaked his ankle or his foot in pregame warmups.
Yep.
He wound up not being able to play many minutes. He's been at least an energy and a hustle guy that they've been pretty relying on in this last stretch of the season. But if you don't have Michael Porter Jr. in there, a guy that really helped them win their only game in this series, they're not going to have enough offense to generate around Jokic to last this out much longer.
Look, and I know we're going long on the first segment, but I want to drill down on this point. Because you can only take so much from the Grizzlies-Thunder series because Ja Morant got hurt. They were up big when Ja goes out. Yeah. They have an energy surge, but they can't sustain it. Lu Dort did not have a great offensive game, and it becomes obscured, right? But when teams are going to try to take away Shai, they're going to try to take away, to some degree, Jalen Williams as a secondary guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lu Dort is going to be the guy with the matchups and the guy that teams are going to say, beat us. Those are the acceptable terms in which we are okay in losing to you. We're not okay in losing to Shai. We're not okay, quite okay, losing to J-Dub, although that's a little more acceptable. Mm-hmm. But we're really okay with losing to Lu Dort if Lu Dort just makes shots. If you remember how Ty Lue tried to play against Russell Westbrook last week in game one, where he just said, hey, Russ, if you make this corner three, your hat. They're not disrespecting Lu Dort that way, theoretically, if we go to the next series and we're saying that's what it is. But Lu Dort is the guy that that's going to have to step up offensively. And I don't know how you felt about the Ja Morant play. He had lost his balance. He thought he was going for the ball. But it was a reckless play. Regardless of whatever it was a really reckless play. It was a low reward play. If you strip Ja Morant, you're still going to get his body. You didn't get the ball. You got all body, and he went flat on his chest. And for people who say that was dirty, I don't necessarily believe it to be dirty, but I understand why you say that.
Yeah, I think it looked like he slipped. My beef is with Scottie Pippen Jr. Just like go up with the layup. Like you didn't need to give the pass to Ja in the first place. But those are just freak accidents. Like I'm not blaming Amen Thompson for what happened to Jimmy Butler either. This is a bang bang play. Two athletic guys going up in the air. You get caught in the air. You got to land somehow. So it's just unfortunate for the Memphis Grizzlies. But it's also more of the same story. It's Ja got hurt again. So I don't know where we take it from here. Just wanted to shout out Alex Caruso for the Thunder, though, because that was a defensive masterclass. And for as much as Josh Giddey is thriving in Chicago, that's why the Oklahoma City Thunder acquired Alex Caruso for those moments specifically. Like I think he had four steals, a block in 23 minutes, just so infectious on defense, doing whatever, taking on guarding one through four. That squad is so good. That's why I can't, like, I want to put it on wax, like, yo, Clippers are going to beat the Thunder, but, like, I just can't.
You came close.
It's so hard to do it, man. It's so hard to do it.
You came close. Now, what do you think about Lu Dort being the offensive guy that if the Clippers make it there, the Clippers are going to say, hey, Lu Dort, you're going to have to beat us.
Yeah, and I would also argue, man, Chet Holmgren hasn't been great either. I mean, he came out in the second half. He had 20 of his 24, but he's been known to kind of disappear and kind of fade to black a little bit. So, yeah, I think you could put the pressure on those tertiary guys to make them beat you.
I think Chet eventually, maybe more than J-Dub, unless we'll get to that next segment or the last part. We'll get to that next segment. Unless there's a star coming your way that you don't see coming, Chet Holmgren has to be that second guy. Because at his size, he has the matchup advantage. He can score at all three levels, theoretically. He unlocks things in a similar way to Kristaps Porzingis unlocking everything for the Boston Celtics when he's healthy. We're just not sure that Chet Holmgren is there quite yet, and maybe J-Dub is better as third option, and Chet, in theory, should be the number two.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best comp, I would say, in terms of, like, role for the best case version of Chet Holmgren is the Kristaps Porzingis of the Celtics. That's exactly right.
Yeah, but, you know, we'll have time, according to Dan. We're going to have plenty of time to talk about Clippers and Thunder in the second round, because we just getting nuggets up out of there. But they might really be up out of there anyway. But the Clippers might clip. Let's just make sure we put that in there. Clippers might clip, and y'all putting a lot of faith in Kawhi Leonard's health. That's all I'm going to say. Y'all putting a lot of faith in Kawhi Leonard's health. Speaking of health, we are going to talk about the Timberwolves and Lakers and Jimmy Butler when we come back on The Good Word. Welcome back to The Good Word with my man Dan Titus. Dan, tonight there will be Prince playing some Purple Rain, some When Doves Cry. And it would not be in honor of the Lakers. It'll be because the Minnesota Timberwolves and Lakers will engage in game three of their first round series. That is tied 1-1. Wild swings from game one to game two. But it seems clear to me, the one thing that's clear to me that stands out from the regular season to now, the Lakers will have a hard time scoring against this Minnesota team. Like, everybody goes and looks at Rudy getting embarrassed by Luka in that one play. But whenever they tried to ISO Rudy, Rudy won the majority of those matchups. It's just that when he loses, it's loud. When Julius Randle commits turnovers, it's loud. When Ant dunks on you, it's loud. Everything that they do is loud. So with that, is this a matter of the Lakers needing to score more? Or is it the matter of, what I believe to be the case, the Timberwolves have to speed this game up against this Lakers team, get shots up early and often, increase the pace here?
That's kind of where I was leaning towards as well. Is like, I felt like in game one, they were kind of dictating and controlling the pace. It seemed like the Lakers struggled with their rotations. They left Naz Reid open a lot. They got all the looks that they wanted in game one, whereas in game two, it was kind of like the Lakers got their lick back in terms of like slowing the pace down, getting more ISO situations and Luka to create and LeBron. Austin Reeves had a better game. So I'm expecting game three to be Chris Finch's adjustment of how can we get Ant in better positions where he's not going to be confused or surprised by the zones that are being thrown at him? Because I think that kind of had him off kilter a little bit. Now that he's had time to look at film, I think we'll see them probably not being allowed to get into their defensive sets as much. And that's to your point, getting in transition, playing with more pace, moving up and down the floor, and just getting more activity offensively from a lot of their role players.
But that's going to be hard to do because Mike Conley is a more deliberate player. Rudy Gobert is a plodding offensive player. Julius Randle, we know he wants to sit and pat that thing.
It's a ball, bro.
The personnel, I think, doesn't call for optimizing the changing of the pace. The one player you have, or the two players that you have Jay McDaniels and you have Ant. Yeah. Naz Reid, who had all the open shots in game one, he had more fouls and, you know, more mic'd up moments than he had actual field goals in game two. And I wonder if the Lakers have been a top five type of defensive team for the better part of 2.5 months, even with, you know, after the Anthony Davis trade, but before Luka debuted and everything else, like they've morphed into a better performing defensive team. I'm not sure if the Timberwolves can get enough possessions. Now, maybe you wind up just trying to tire the Lakers out. LeBron was talking about, if you're not dead tired, something wrong with you. In a game that it felt like the Lakers dominated in game two. And you get a couple days, you get that extra day off in between the travel. But Luka's still food. And also LeBron, you still got to worry about how his body is going to hold up as the playoff series go on. I'm just very curious if Minnesota, with their current starting lineup together, their first five, if they're built to play that level of pace. Because they've gotten off the slow starts in games one and two. They just rebounded in such a profound way in game one. We forget that. But I don't know if this is the starting lineup that you need to be rolling with all the way around, unless Conley's going to be a lot more aggressive, or you're going to just basically be throwing a lot of stuff up to Rudy and daring the Lakers to shift their defense in a way that they're not used to.
So that's what I'm wondering. Like, I feel like this is going to be the Dante DiVincenzo game. Mm. He hasn't been playing well at all, and I think he's gotten good looks, especially game one where he missed, you know, majority of his shots, except that, you know, half court heave. But he hasn't really done much, and I think that this is the game where he's going to be more assertive, probably get more threes out in transition. He's just got to get unlocked a little bit. He's only averaging 6.5 points in this series thus far, shooting 39%. I don't think that's going to hold. He's only shooting 14% from three. This is a guy that shot, you know, well over, you know, damn near 40% for the year. So I think if they can get the ball out, get it moving, get those threes up, I think it's going to be one of those run type games where we're just going to see Minnesota go on a, like, a, you know, 8-3 surge, and then Lakers fire back, and then That's the kind of up and down game I'm expecting here. So in order to do that effectively, Dante DiVincenzo's got to shoot well. And I think that that's only going to further, you know, allow the Timberwolves to keep up that pace. Because Mike Conley, like, he's not the same. He's just the guy that sets up the offense. Try not to hunt him on defense. Hide him as best as you can. So the way to combat that to me is just give Dante more minutes or more opportunities in the offense.
When they thought Dante was going to be a secondary playmaker when they picked him up in that Julius Randle trade, you know, Karl Towns trade anyway, they thought, hey, this is the wild card here in a way that he's able to play the point guard position. And when you're playing with Anthony Edwards, who's ball dominant, you know, even if he's setting up guys, he's still initiating a lot of offense. You can still have him there, you know, on the weak side to sort of attack closeouts and just be able to initiate and move the ball. Ant, this is an Ant series to some degree, or this is an Ant game. I don't think this is an Ant series. One of these games at home is going to have to be an Ant game because I think Julius Randle has played remarkably well, all things considered. I don't expect him to keep playing remarkably well.
Right.
Ant is only shooting 40% from the field. Like that one donkey head on Jackson Hayes, that was almost cathartic. It was like, the lane is finally open. I got to get there. That sort of thing. Now, to the Lakers, Austin Reeves seemed to find something in game 2 that he didn't have in game 1, right? How much do you think this is going to be the Austin Reeves, Luka Doncic series over the LeBron James type of series? LeBron is doing a really good job plugging in the holes, doing a lot of the intangibles, and not having to be primary playmaker and everything else, which he always had to be when Anthony Davis there. Now he doesn't have to be that. Do you want LeBron? Do you want to force or tilt your defense to push LeBron into a position where he has to exert more energy early in games? Or do you say, you know what, Luka, go ahead and feast like you did in game 1. We're going to cover everyone else. Like there, I feel like there's multiple ways that Minnesota can play the Lakers and multiple ways that the Lakers can sort of focus their attack.
Yeah, if I'm the Minnesota Timberwolves, I would try to let Luka cook and then cut off the water for everybody else. Because when Austin Reeves gets his confidence, I feel like this team has just a little bit more spark that if LeBron doesn't have to play hero ball, that's right. The best place for the Lakers to be. And I think that floor has been raised by Austin Reeves' amazing play with Luka on the floor. Like, they have a really nice tandem together. If you cut that off, like, when Austin Reeves struggles, the Lakers struggle. So I would just try to make, again, Luka's going to get his 30. He's going to get his opportunities to score. Let that be that, and let the role players, cut off the role players, because I think that that's where, I think that if you're looking at it in totality of it, getting them off their flow offensively is only going to translate on defense. Rui Hachimura has been a guy that's been all over the place lately. He's still going through an injury, but he's going to be attacked in switches. He's the key. JJ Redick called him the key to executing their small ball lineup. If he's struggling on offense and he can't get back on defense, it's going to make it a little bit more difficult for the Lakers to have the success that they had last game, where it seems like everything was kind of falling in line and firing on all cylinders, where I think this one's going to be the disruptive game. Like this is where, like, I don't know where this series is going to go. Like, I picked the Timberwolves to win this series, but this is where the in-game strategies and the series adjustments start to happen. And that's where I'm curious. Where is Finch going to go here? Where's JJ Redick going to pull out of his toolkit to be like, oh, you haven't seen this look before. This is going to be a really pivotal game for that.
That's why I love playing basketball, because you find out who can really coach. And you find out, at game 4 of the series, y'all, I'm going to tell you this. Very rarely, after game 4, do you have these masterclass of adjustments. They're all very subtle. They're all very small. And they're all just like wrinkles that you throw into the game. And maybe you figure something out. Because if you've been around your team for 90 games and then you discover something in game 90, yeah. All right, cool. You have been doing coaching malpractice up until this point. Now let's go to the Golden State-Houston series. Jimmy Butler, the injury report hasn't come out yet, but he had an MRI. Deep glute muscle contusion. That just looks like it hurts, right? It just looks like it hurts, and it's not something that you can even shoot up because it's your tailbone. Like, it's just something. I talked to someone yesterday, and they saw it. It was like, ooh, that's a week. Like, someone said that initially, like, oh, that's a week. That's not even something that you can necessarily shoot up. Jimmy Butler's a tough dude. I don't think the Houston Rockets are worried about the Golden State Warriors beating them if Jimmy Butler isn't there. He has to be there. By the time of this recording, it's Friday. Later on today, we're going to get the injury report. Game 3 is on Saturday, 8:30 on ABC. So there's another day of recovery and everything else. If nothing else, I would – this is just me guessing. This is not a report thing. This is just me guessing. I would guess that Jimmy doesn't play in Game 3 and plays in Game 4. You see what happens if you can ride the home court and win Game 3 without him. Maybe Steph loses his mind again. But if – and then you can buy yourself some time. You can buy yourself 2 or 3 more days. And maybe you don't even play Jimmy in Game 4 if you win Game 3. And then you bring him back, you know, for Game 5, however that goes. But if you lose Game 3, then that might put you in a position where you're forced to play him because you don't want to go down 3-1 facing the prospect of a Game 5 in Houston. I'm just really fascinated because I don't think Golden State can win this series with the players they have without Jimmy Butler, period.
Neither do I. And I mean, I think, you know, with Jimmy Butler in the lineup, it just gives, I mean, we saw what the Warriors were before Jimmy Butler got there, right? It was an overly dependent team on Stephen Curry. I think that's what we're going to get for Game 3 here. I don't expect Jimmy to play either. It just seemed like the severity of the injury and how in discomfort he was after the game and what they're saying in the reports, I think it would behoove the Warriors to give him an extra day because they don't play again until Monday. So, you know, that would be a nice, you know, 4 or 5 days of rest there from the previous game for him to get ready. And the fact that they stole one in Houston, I think, puts him in a position to be able to do that. That being said, if Jimmy can't get right by Game 4, then the Warriors are going to be in trouble because the consistency – you're going to have to go to Jonathan Kuminga more. And I think we saw in the limited minutes that he has played, he just doesn't have the basketball IQ or the, I don't know, maybe it's just he just needs the reps to get comfortable. But, like, he's not one of those guys you can just plug into a game.
Right. He's not plug and play.
Yeah, he's not a plug and play guy. And so in his emotions, mentally, he's been – Steve Kerr's been doing nasty work.
Doing him wrong. Doing him wrong, baby. I'm trying to get paid and you out here giving me DMPs.
Yeah, and he's not doing his best case to make someone want to pay him in the offseason right now. So either or, I think there's just not enough offense to be generated outside of Stephen Curry on a consistent manner that I think Houston won't have a field day just playing their physical style of play. Jalen Green finally coming about. And I love that he admitted that the moment just got to him. He had his legs were shaking. He's never been in a playoff environment before, but he looked real comfortable in Game 2. And Şengün playing better. Yeah. They're getting they have all their intangible guys to kind of step up and get this victory in Game 3 without Jimmy Butler. And if Game 4 doesn't have Jimmy Butler, well, we'll see. We'll cross that bridge when we get there. But I think if the Warriors can get by and sneak by with a win here, that's going to be a great look for them.
You're playing with Gravy.
It's going to be pretty hard to do.
You're pretty Gravy. I don't see many paths offensively for Golden State to have enough consistent offense outside of Stephen Curry where, oh, Jimmy Butler isn't there. Like Ime Udoka said, well, we can crowd Curry a lot more.
Yeah.
Like he basically said it. Like ain't a whole lot of tricks here.
Let it's Brandon Bajewski beat you. Okay.
Exactly. Those are the acceptable terms in which you will allow yourself to get beaten. Maybe it's Pajemski, who is an up and down player to begin with. Maybe it's Moses Moody. Kuminga doesn't seem like he's all the way mentally there. You're not going to ask Draymond Green to do more offensively. He's already pretty taxed. That's why it's a tough spot for them because they were one of the top teams. It's another case of this is why you don't play with your food in the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
This is not even from a standpoint of the players, from the standpoint of the organization. If you're going to make a move, you don't wait until you're 10th in the Western Conference to then go and shake up your roster. You've got to be really, really proactive because the West, the difference between second seed and seventh seed is so minute. Maybe they made this trade a little bit sooner, and I know we're playing hindsight and everything else, and that's really unfair of me, but it's just a bigger picture conversation here. Man, that's really tough to do. And now, maybe if you're not playing Houston, you're not playing, you know, Amen Thompson, you don't fall on your back, you don't fall on your ass, all that type of stuff. It's just one of those things.
That was not the series. Like, as much as everyone wanted to talk about, oh, it'd be great to play the Lakers and the, and they wind up with Houston because of the drama with Ime and Steph or whatever. But like, the Houston Rockets are a way more physical team that I did. That if I'm the Warriors, I would not have wanted then to
you
play
want,
that
you
team
don't
in
want
the first
that.
Round.
You don't want that physical matchup.
No.
You want the inexperience, but you don't want the physicality. They're second in the West for a reason.
Yeah.
You asking for trouble. Be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. And this is where they are. When we come back, we got to have an uncomfortable conversation. It's time for the last word with Dan Titus. Dan, Dame Dollar came back in game two of the Pacers-Milwaukee series. Same bat time, same bat channel. They're down 2-0 headed home. I don't think that this series is over by any stretch. But Giannis has had monster games in this series, and it's not helping. I think two names that we're going to be endlessly curious about going into the offseason will be the futures of Ja Morant in Memphis, because they do a lot of talking, a lot of barking, not a lot of winning when it really matters. And Giannis Antetokounmpo, because his teams have won a grand total of one playoff series since winning the championship in 2021. And that team is getting older and more expensive, which is really, really hard to do, to build a championship team with the constraints of today's CBA. I'm not ready to say that his days in Milwaukee are numbered. I'm not ready to go there. Because every time we seem to think something, John Horst pulls something out of his ass. And we're like, oh yeah, well now he's going to resign for a couple more years. But do the Bucks have any more paths to take if this situation, if Dame and Doc Rivers and Giannis cannot at least get out of the first round of the playoffs?
I wrote about this on Yahoo Sports. My biggest question coming into this Eastern Conference playoff round was, when is Giannis going to, the outcome of this series is going to determine whether Giannis decides to ask for out. And they were a first round exit last year to the hands of the Indiana Pacers. They're looking like another first round exit to the hand of the Indiana Pacers. But what's more damning is that, look at what they have. What is the franchise going to be able to do to get assets around Giannis to win? You already mortgaged your future getting Damian Lillard.
Mm-hmm.
You were probably better off keeping Chris Middleton and his no ankles than it was to acquire Kyle Kuzma, because he's just been trash. And so Brook Lopez, old as hell. Torian Prince, not a starting small forward. I just don't know where they can go. Like, look at their draft capital for the next 5 years. They don't have a pick in 2025 because they owe that to New Orleans for the Jrue Holiday trade. 2026, they got a pick swap with New Orleans, so that's not going to be good. 2027, no picks because that's part of the Jrue Holiday trade. 2028, Portland has the right to a pick swap because of the Damian Lillard trade. 2029, no first-round picks because of Damian Lillard. 2030, another pick swap with Damian Lillard. So, like, you don't have draft capital. You don't have enough sellable assets in a trade. So what do you do? I don't know how you can literally sit there in an exit interview and tell Giannis, oh, we're built to win for the next 3 years. That window is shutting faster than they thought. And I think Giannis is going to end up asking for out because there's no other option for him to win another championship. It ain't going to be in Milwaukee.
Yeah, he's going to be in a tough spot. He's in a tough spot. The franchise is in a tough spot. No one wants to willingly tell their franchise guy who they've nurtured and had for 11 years. He was drafted in 2013.
Yeah.
Like he's been there already for a long time. I think the crazy thing is when you look at the recent NBA champions, they have been teams who have grown their players through the draft. Boston, Tatum and Brown. Before that, the Denver Nuggets, Jokic, Murray, Porter. Before that, Golden State, a different iteration, Steph, Jordan Poole, Draymond Green, a lot of those guys, the core of those guys, 2021, Milwaukee, like that group. It's really hard to go somewhere else and say, okay, just add me and we're going to win a championship. Because you have to give up so much for a player like Giannis. And you have to retrofit your team around a guy like Giannis. And you have to wonder how much wear and tear is on Giannis Antetokounmpo's body already. Like, remember, this is the first playoff series that he's actually been healthy in the past couple of years. So there's a lot of questions on both sides. But I tend to agree that at least we will start having more out loud conversations about Giannis and his future, because we know he wants to win. He's a go hard, and the Bucks have by and large done right by him, but it's really hard in today's NBA when the mantra is if players help you win, then you keep them. But if they become more expensive as they get older, but they don't become better as they get older. And then you go and make a move for Damian Lillard, which nobody said was a bad move. None of us sat here and said that getting Dame Lillard last year was a bad move. It prevented him from going to Miami when coming off of that previous year. Miami had put the Milwaukee Bucks out in the first round of the playoffs. So if you add Damian Lillard to that group, everybody says, why did you let that happen on your watch? Why did you let Damian Lillard go somewhere else on your watch? You've just had an endless string of bad luck since winning in 2021. The problem is, will Giannis Antetokounmpo see that as an endless string of bad luck or bad decisions? It's all in his own eyes, I think. And I think before we write them off, I think Damian Lillard coming back in this series, he's going to be heard from.
Yeah,
we haven't heard from Kyle Kuzma, but we will hear from Damian Lillard.
Yeah, I don't think the series is over. My forethought was more about if they lose. I still feel like they still definitely have a chance to come back in the series. And Dame hasn't arrived yet. He's still looking. He was kind of getting into his game flow a little bit more. Obviously, he's been out with the blood clot. So I think we'll see a revived Bucks. The Bucks team in Milwaukee coming for this next series here, or this next game. But don't let that take away from the Pacers and how well that they've played.
Exactly.
Because like it's hard to, as much as I thought it was a good pick to pick in the Bucks, I didn't expect the Pacers to play this well. And their depth, I think that's the one key for them, is like they're not only do they get the starter production, but their bench is outstanding. So I don't know, man. Like even if the Bucks can come back and, you know, maybe potentially tie up the series at home, It's still hard to project like the way the Pacers play them and just kind of letting Giannis beat you. Like Giannis is averaging 35-15, shooting 68% from the field. Like that's ridiculous, 65%. But as long as no one else does anything, like you're pretty good money. Like so it's kind of the same theory of you know, if I'm the Timberwolves, I'll just let Luka go ahead, go get your 30. We're gonna cut everybody else off, and then you kind of handle it that way. But I know this is another good series that I'm intrigued if Giannis and the Bucks can make this comeback.
Yeah, the Pacers got six guys scoring double figures. Like they can beat you all the way around. Like Tyrese Halliburton hasn't even had a blow up game yet. I don't know if he will.
He doesn't need to.
But he doesn't need to. Like this series is so fascinating, but you have to ask, can the Milwaukee Bucks win four of the next five games in this series, starting with the next two games at the crib in Milwaukee? It's going to be endlessly fascinating. I can't wait for this weekend. We got a slate of games Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I'll be back with you guys Monday. My man, Dan Titus, really appreciate you, brother.
Always, Vin.
That is Dan Titus. Dakota London is working the boards behind us to make sure everything goes smoothly. Thanks to him. And we will be back on Monday with another episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.